Accession number 20017, Reel 1.
Richard Hill, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil.
Which year was this?
1924.
How did you come to be born in Brazil, please?
After the First World War, my father was demobbed. He obviously couldn't find suitable employment in the UK. He had an opportunity of going to Brazil for a firm that provided stevedores for the port of Rio de Janeiro. And in the course of being there, he met my mother, who was born of British parents who had been out there for several years, and they got married.
Did you stay long in Rio?
Yes, I stayed there from my date of birth until September of 1936, when my parents sent me over to a boarding school in England.
So what language did you grow up with?
I was always at English schools when I was going through my early education in Rio. And therefore my Portuguese, which was the language, to answer your question, I could speak it and I could understand it, but I certainly wasn't fluent in it.
And can you tell me about leaving Brazil, please?
Yes, I left on the Highland Monarch. I was put under the guardianship of the ship's captain. And I arrived in Southampton, I should think about a fortnight later, when my grandmother, who was to be my guardian in England, and my uncle and aunt met me and took me back to Carshalton Beaches.
Which year was this?
1936.
What happened to you between 36 and 39?
I was at boarding school throughout that period.
Whereabouts?
Mayfield College in Sussex. It's a Roman Catholic school run by the Severian Order of Monks.
Is that in Mayfield Village?
Mm-hmm. Sorry, may I just correct that? The local village is Mayfield, but it's about 2 miles out of Mayfield, up a very steep hill known as Pile Hill.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Yes, I did. Yes.
Under what circumstances?
My mother had come over to bring my brother with me to join the school in 1939, in September of 39. And she became increasingly worried about the international situation vis-a-vis Nazi Germany. And she did, in fact, wish to take both of us back to Brazil with her. The headmaster of the school persuaded her to do otherwise, which I thought was very courageous of him and quite correct. And by the time she'd made up her mind, which was to take us back, war had been declared. And obviously, I suppose the risk of going across the Atlantic with her two eldest sons of four caused her to reconsider, and she decided to leave us here in the hope that the war would not be too prolonged.
Did you have any personal feelings about the declaration of war?
Well, I did, actually, because in Brazil there was a Nazi movement. There was a very big German contingent in Brazil overall, mostly centred in the south of the country, but also obviously in Rio de Janeiro, the capital. And these entregalistas used to wear green shirts, as opposed to the brown, with the swastikas on. And on Sundays in particular, I think that was because it was on Sundays and weekends, they used to have demonstrations outside synagogues or Jewish places of worship. They didn't have weapons, they just had sticks. But it was very unpleasant, and although I personally never witnessed it, I understand that when the Jewish community came out of the church, they'd be very often attacked, and a riotous situation would develop.
But you saw the Integralistas, did you?
Yes, I saw the Integralistas. Oh yes, they were quite a powerful unit. We also used to have in those days the Graf Zeppelin, which always fascinated everyone in Rio. But of course that, as I recall, had the swastika on it. And if it didn't, it certainly had swastikas on the airfield that it landed, this well displayed. And there was also, I don't know if it was called Lufthansa then, a regular German flight, and that did have a swastika on, and I used to see them going over our house in Rio and out to sea and obviously back towards Europe, and vice versa.
What does Integralista mean?
To be honest, I don't know. It was a name given to a movement, and again, I can't remember this, which had a very extrovert and quite powerful speaker, leader, who used to generally stir things up. Of course, Brazil was pretty well a dictatorship then. It was under Getúlio Vargas, who was the president, who had actually moved into Rio, I think, can't remember the year, and, de-seated the government and took over the country. And he held it in his power. Very pro-German it was, until the Americans applied pressure, I suspect, when they came into the war after Pearl Harbor, because I was in this country then. And they started to veer then towards the Allies. And in point of fact, they did produce a battalion, not of Integralistas, but of Brazilians, which fought in Italy.
Were the Integralistas Germans or Brazilians?
Oh, no, Brazilians. No doubt well supported by the Germans and probably even schooled by them, but no, Brazilians definitely.
What kind of people joined it?
Well, difficult to say, but it must have been the lower middle class and possibly upwards. They may have persuaded the people who lived in the favelas, they may have persuaded some of them to join without realizing what they were subscribing to, I suspect, but I think it was a fairly well organized unit, and it was a political party, in its sense. It wanted power.
Did they have any kind of arms they paraded with?
Not that I ever recall. I only saw them with these sticks, rather like broomsticks, that they would rush around with.
Did you feel threatened by them?
Myself, no. I felt very antagonistic towards them because the British community weren't all that well disposed toward the Germans. Even when I was there, and that was before Chamberlain's entrance, as schoolboys, there was always great competition. I don't mean competition on the playing fields, but between the German boys and the British boys. On those sort of occasions when we met, there would be national sports days and things like that, and I myself can remember having a very prolonged fight with a German chap on one of these occasions, and my mother was apparently utterly humiliated, and I was sent home or taken home.
What was the source of the rivalry, do you think? The First World War or what?
I think it was. It must have been the First World War, yes. It was the sort of thing, anything German is better than British. It was that sort of attitude.
What was life like for you in Rio pre-war?
Well, for me, it was wonderful. I really did enjoy myself. My parents, strangely enough, took very little, not interest, that would be the wrong word. They took very little, they didn't keep me in the back garden or anything like that. During holidays, they were quite happy to let me go roaming in the forests and the lagoons, and spent a lot of time on the beach. And I had a wonderful time. I used to go out and harpoon fish, and We had a raft, another friend and myself, which was in the lagoon. Really overgrown lagoon now. I believe it's an absolute showpiece nowadays. I haven't been back to it. I haven't seen it, but my mother tells me it is. And it was very wild country, in there, you know. But it was lovely country to roam in. And we used to do all sorts of things, terrible things by today's standards, but we used to trap birds, set up traps. And I don't mean traps that damage them, but we would capture them. I'm not going to describe the system, but it didn't do the bird any harm, and we let them loose. And we did things like that, and we were always very interested in animals that, you know, one could capture. There were all sorts of lizards and parakeets and things like that.
Now, coming back to England, what happened to you after the declaration of war?
Well, I was at boarding school, and I stayed there until 1941. I took my school certificate in 1940, and that was during the Battle of Britain. And the skies over Mayfield were a regular battlefield for Messerschmitts, Spitfires, Hurricanes, lots of them, or many of them, actually piloted by a Polish squadron, which must have been somewhere in that vicinity, or responsible for the skies, because some of them were shot down and they were actually buried in the school cemetery.
Can you describe any incidents?
Well, yes, we had one occasion when there was a dogfight going on. This is actually during the school certificate examination. You could look out of the window and get a little bit of diversion if you wish. And there was a tremendous dogfight on that day. I think it was about, must have been about June or July of that year. And the year I took it, 1940, that's right. And we could see a Polish Spitfire, presumably, could have been a Hurricane, actually shot down, spiralling down, and it landed quite near between the sort of school and the swimming pool that we had there. I mean, that was the nearest incident, but apart from seeing these regular dogfights going on all the time, practically, at that stage of the war.
Did you ever come across any shot down aircrew?
No, I didn't, but a lot of the brothers and the monks went there and had a look at it, and a lot of the senior boys went there and saw it, yes. The school were rather cautious with me, to be honest, in the war, because they knew my parents were overseas, and they had a scheme where the boys used to go out every night, not in groups, the senior boys, and be stationed on various high spots around Mayfield. And the idea was that they were observers until the darkness arrived, to see if there were any parachutists that might be landed. And, I was a senior boy then, and I felt very affronted, and I felt I was missing out on something because I was not allowed to participate in these groups. And similarly, when the boys were taken down to see this damaged aircraft again, I was not included. And they said it was because my parents were overseas, and they felt that, unless they had that permission for me to do these sort of things, like become party of an observation group, that it wasn't within their jurisdiction to take that decision.
What kind of parachutes did they have in mind?
Well, this was presumably the German parachute divisions, the sort of things they used at Crete. In 1940, there was always this threat, of invasion. Very strong, of course, it was too.
How did you feel at that time that the Battle of Britain was going? Did you have any opinions about it?
Oh, I had tremendous opinions about it because we used to have these reports that we had shot down 185 planes and only lost 60, but we all knew. And the brothers were very good on this. They used to sort of brief us on this, if you ask them. We all knew that our situation vis-a-vis both aircraft and pilots to fly those fighter aircraft was very much a thin line by then. We were very short of them. So we were almost finding out every day, what the score was. How many had we shot down and how many had we lost.
What did you think of England's prospects at that time in the war?
I think probably due to my period in Brazil, I thought then that we were going to lose the war. I just felt that they were, you know, the way they were trained, their invincibility in swarming across Europe. This is when I was at school, and having seen the German influence in Brazil.
Had you expected at that time a German invasion?
Oh, very much so, in 1940, yes, I had. Mm.
Did your school friends share your opinions about the prospects for the war?
That would be difficult for me to answer. No, I couldn't answer that one. I mean, I just don't know, that's the truth.
Did the war affect you in any other way at this time in 39-41?
No, it didn't. The rations at the school became far more limited with food. I know that we got a lot of spam and special foods that were prepared for war purposes for the population. On my holidays, things were pretty normal as far as living was concerned. I mean, there were still buses running and cinemas going and food at home. That was my grandmother's house. But my cousins, two of my cousins lived with my grandmother because my uncle and auntie, we also lived with my grandmother, with their parents. And we had three or four friends, and we used to go out regularly on cycle rides and things like that. And of course, I think we're getting into 1941 now. Well, certainly when the Germans started bombing London, Carshalton Beaches, when Crystal Palace was bombed, when Croydon Airport was bombed, we were all playing tennis on Sutton Hard Court Tennis Club, and we could see it. And when we saw the bombs falling on the Croydon Airport, you immediately thought they would affect you, you know, 5 or 6 miles away. But we witnessed those sort of things, and of course we certainly witnessed the bombing of London. Yes, you could see that.
Can you tell me about your Blitz memories, please? Your memories of the bombing?
Well, just the drone of the planes all night long, the tremendous fires that were raging in London. The fact that my uncle, who worked at the Standard Bank of South Africa across London Bridge from London Bridge Station, he used to have most terrible troubles getting to the office, you know, very often having to come back early, before nightfall, because they knew the next bombardment would be due to start.
How did public morale seem to stand up to the bombing?
Oh, I thought it was fantastic. Absolute determination to withstand it.
Mm. Did any bombs fall near you?
Not when I was there, no. But my aunt's house was hit by a V1 bomb. And Pam's home, there was a V1 landed right next door and did a tremendous lot of damage to her home, too.
This was presumably later when you were on the
continent?
Yes.
It was after Normandy that this happened. No, I beg your pardon. I was at Normandy, you're quite right. And it was after Normandy that I saw the damage. But my grandmother and aunt's house was completely demolished.
Did you have any ambitions yourself as regards the war, about what you intended to do?
Oh, absolutely, yes. I was determined to... absolutely determined to join up. There's no question on that. If I'd gone back to Brazil, which is the last thing I wanted to do, I would have had to have joined their rather clapped-out army. And I suspect that if I'd gone there as an Englishman, I would have probably been sent to the interior and I'd have, I don't know, malaria or whatever they have up there. So I had no wish to go back to Brazil, but I was absolutely determined to stay on here. And my grandmother had to connive with me to stop pressure from my parents to get me back. There was some talk that they might get me back to the States, and from the States I could get down to Brazil. And I said to my grandmother, well, I just couldn't bear the thought of going back. And she interceded on my behalf with them and said that she thought it was wrong and that I was very much against returning. Anyway, that sort of worked itself through, because shortly after I joined up, so it didn't... by then it was too late, you know.
Were your ambitions for the army or what?
Well, that's a good point you've raised now. I had a great friend at boarding school, and we both decided that we would join the tank corps. We had both been in the OTC, and our OTC had close links with a light armoured unit, I think, from Lancashire. It was an army unit, but it was a, as I say, its headquarters were in Lancashire, and they used to come down and judge the Cert A examinations which we had each year, and they'd bring two or three of their very, very light tank, well, they weren't tanks, they were in armoured car units down, and we used to swarm all over them and get very excited about it. So we decided that we would join the tank corps and that we'd both volunteer on the same day at the same time. Now, the point was that my friend Pat Bourne lived in Oxford, and I lived in Castleton Beaches. We'd just finished school then, you know, and we're making up our minds on this particular approach. And when I went to Croydon, I had my preliminary medical, which I passed. It was a very superficial thing, medical. Then I went for an interview with an army sergeant, and he said, I hear you want to join the army. And he said, you've passed your preliminary medical, and as far as we can see, there's no reason why you shouldn't join the unit of your choice. What do you want to go to? So I immediately said, well, I want to join the tank corps. And he right away said, well, I'm very sorry, but you have actually picked the unit that he said is very much under stress or strain at this time, because he said the battles are going on in the desert. He said, well, we haven't got sufficient tanks really to train people. Any tanks that are coming off out of production are going straight to the Middle East. And we just cannot at the moment take any recruits. So I really was flummoxed on this one. So I said, well, I really don't know what to do, because I said, I've got a friend who's also joining the tank corps, and we both wanted to train together and hopefully even get to the same unit eventually. But he said, well, I'm sorry, that's the story. Do you fancy the East Surrey Regiment? Well, I didn't. I didn't want at that stage to go into an infantry regiment. I said, no, I'll have to consider this. Because I was a volunteer, I was only 17 and a half or something, you know, going, trying to get in early. Not falsifying my age, but I mean, signing on early. So I rang Pat Bourne in Oxford that night and was absolutely horrified. This is the way things go, isn't it? To hear that he'd been accepted with open arms and signed on, and it was all signed, sealed, and delivered. So I said to him, well, I don't know what to do. I said, Pat, can we, can you withdraw at all and we'll reconsider? He said, well, I can't. He said, I've signed everything. And he said, anyway, I've made up my mind and I've talked to my parents and it's all finalized. So I thought, well, fair enough. So I went back to the recruiting office the next day, saw the same sergeant, got the same answer despite having told him the other story. And as I was going out, a naval petty officer approached me and said, what unit are you joining, Sonny, or such comment. And I said, well, I'm going to join, I had hoped to join the tank corps, but they're full and I can't. He said, well, have you considered joining the Navy? And I said, well, no, I haven't. And he said, well, you know, the Navy has a lot to offer. And I said, well, what sort of job would I be doing? And he obviously wasn't a good salesman, but he said, well, we have a great need for stokers. Well, I still thought that stokers literally shovel coal. And so without any hesitation, I said, oh, no, I'm not going to do that. He said, well, what do you want? What did you want to do? What did you hope to do? I said, well, I wanted to join the army, but I can't. I want to join the tank corps. And he said, well, have you thought of joining the Marines? And this is where it all came to happen. And I said, no, they're military police. I'd always thought they sort of stood in the middle of the ship and, you know, divided the ship into the officers away from the men. So he said, well, I don't think that. Come and see my friend, Sergeant so-and-so. So he took me in, he introduced me. And this chap right away said, no, you've got the wrong idea. He said, the Marines now. He said, we don't publicise it, but he said, we have a vast arena of jobs available. He said, it is true, we are on battleships and we do supply the gun crews and we do have responsibilities to maintain guards. But he said, it's not the sort of situation that you're thinking it is. And he said, the best thing you can do, I think, he said, is to join the Marines. And he said, you've got your cert A and you've got your school certificate. He said, if you joined, you could even apply for a commission. And I said, yes, but what would I do? He said, well, we do raids on beaches. He said, we do all sorts of tasks, he said, which are just not publicised. And he said, we are one of the finest fighting forces in the country. So I said, well, look, I'd like to think about this. And he said, well, do that. But he said, give it serious thought, because he said, I think you would fit in very well, he said, because I used to like games and things like that. He said, I think you'd fit in very well. But I liked the chap, and I went back the next morning, and I said, yes, I would wish to join the Marines. And he said, well, look, he said, there is a scheme. He said, it's called the Y scheme. And he said, it's for young people with potential to become officers. And he said, you've still got to go through the ranks. And he said, you'll get no preference, but you will wear a little yellow flesh below your lapel, before your regimental tag on the shoulder. And he said, at the end of your training, he said, you will be interviewed. But he said, of course, there's no guarantee that you will be accepted. And he said, a lot of it depends upon how you measure up to your training and to the interview that will follow. And he said, but there you are. He said, I suggest you do it that way. So I said, well, what do I have to do to go on the Y scheme? He said, well, you've got to sign this form here. He said, you'll have to go now for a very, very strict medical in London. And furthermore, you'll also have to take an intelligence test. And you'll probably have to undergo a very much tougher interview than the one you'll receive at the end of your initial training. So I said, right, I'll do that, and I did. And then I was sent off about 2 or 3 months later. I was called up and sent off to the initial training centre at Limpston in Devon. It's now called the Commando Training Centre, I think. Yes, it is. In Limpston. And I said, I don't know the numbers, but it seemed to me that there about 600 of us arrived that week, and we did our six-week training. And at the end of the training, when the platoons had all passed out in quite an impressive ceremony, you know, the Marines are very good on this parading and things like that sort of activity. We were told then by the adjutant, I would assume, that as he addressed us all, that our postings would be on the board the next day.